Today is Friday, December 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The United Nations Secretary General says the world must learn from the pandemic.
As we build a strong recovery, we must seize the opportunity for change.
Plus, how do some of the vaccines work?
Synthesize that messenger RNA that has the right information in it, inject that into muscle. Muscle goes, oh, I know what to do with messenger RNA.
And how do satellites in orbit above the Earth stay secure? We'll have these stories and more next. The United Nations Secretary General said on Thursday the damage COVID-19 has done globally will not be undone by a vaccine alone, and a full recovery will take years and possibly decades.
Extreme poverty is rising. The threat of famine looms. We face the biggest global recession in eight decades. And these intergenerational impacts are not due to COVID-19 alone. They are the result of long-term fragilities, inequalities, and injustices that have been exposed by the pandemic. It's time to reset. As we build a strong recovery, we must seize the opportunity for change.
Secretary General Antonio Guterres said that, quote, looking ahead, the recovery from COVID-19 must address the pre-existing conditions it has exposed and exploited, from gaps in basic services to an overheated planet, end quote. Globally, there are more than 65 million confirmed cases of COVID-19, with the United States leading not only with the largest number of cases, but also with the most fatalities. Individual states face a critical deadline in their battle against COVID-19, and AP correspondent Mike Gracia explains.
With COVID-19 deaths having reached an all-time single-day high in the United States this week, states face a critical deadline today. The states must submit their requests for doses of the Pfizer vaccine by the end of the day and specify where they want the vaccine to be shipped. Meantime, according to the tally kept by Johns Hopkins University, the U.S. recorded 3,157 coronavirus deaths on Wednesday. The previous single-day high was 2,603 deaths on April 15th. Many states appear set to follow guidance from the CDC to put healthcare workers and nursing home patients first in line. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers wants
quantities large enough to vaccinate all 450,000 members of our healthcare workforce and to begin vaccinating Wisconsinites who are high risk.
According to the COVID tracking project, coronavirus hospitalizations in the U.S. hit an all-time high of more than 100,000 on Wednesday. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Most of the western state of California may soon be under a coronavirus stay-at-home order. The AP's Ed Donahue has that part of the story.
Governor Gavin Newsom says this was expected.
The final surge in this pandemic.
A record number of people are in California hospitals.
Regions where the ICU capacity is falling below 15%. We are now mandating that we are implementing a stay-at-home order for 3 weeks.
Newsom says four out of the five regions in California could reach that threshold soon. Hair salons, bars, and casinos would close. Retail stores would be at 20% capacity and only takeout at restaurants.
There is light at the end of the tunnel. We are a few months away from truly seeing real progress with the vaccine.
A Republican lawmaker accused Newsom of disrupting daily life without releasing details behind the decisions. I'm Ed Donahue.
VOA special contributor Greta Van Susteren recently spoke with Francis Collins over Skype. Now, he's the director of the National Institutes of Health, or NIH, in the United States. And she asked him about the role the government played in fast-tracking vaccine development.
Traditionally, it takes 8 to 10 years to develop a vaccine against a new pathogen. This has been done in less than a year. The U.S. government pulled all of the resources together to make sure the coordination was happening. Operation Warp Speed made it possible also to get rid of some of those long delays that oftentimes vex the process, where you go to phase one and then you have to wait many months before you go to phase two. All of those things were synchronized in an unprecedented way, but not by doing any compromising at all on safety. These will probably be amongst the most highly tested vaccines ever in terms of their safety and efficacy. And the good news is the first two that are going to get looked at by FDA in the coming weeks look extremely good, with efficacy over 90%, which is better than most of us had dared to hope, and safety record that also looks extremely good. So we are in a good place to begin to see how we might get COVID-19 behind us, but it's going to take a lot of months to get there for everybody.
I don't want to hope or expect there's going to be another virus coming down the road, but I assume that, you know, it's inevitable sometime, and you know, whether it's sooner rather than later. But has the U.S. learned something, U.S. government learned something, like stripped away some of the red tape so that we can look forward in future times that it will take a shorter time to get a vaccine than 8 or 9 years?
Absolutely. We've learned a lot, and we've documented all along the way ways that things can be done more efficiently. And this accomplishment of having vaccines that are ready to go into individuals in less than a year is certainly going to be the norm in the future. And maybe we could even do it a little faster, although it would be pretty hard to go faster than this. You just still have to run the trials and wait to see whether the vaccine works, and you can only speed that up so much. But I do hope, and I'm part of this decision and discussion that's going on right now, that we don't slip back into complacency once we get past COVID-19, because there's another pandemic out there. I don't know whether it's 5 years from now or 10 years from now or next year. And it probably could be another coronavirus, or it might be an influenza virus. And this is just the nature of our world. And anybody who thinks, oh, we're over that, look at history. We're not likely to be.
All right. Moderna and Pfizer, as I understand it, both have something called, or the sort of the science behind it is something called messenger RNA. Are they very different vaccines or very similar?
They're quite similar. Basically, messenger RNA is the part of a nucleic acid that codes for protein. And this is a very clever way to make a vaccine, where you basically synthesize that messenger RNA that has the right information in it, inject that into muscle. Muscle goes, oh, I know what to do with messenger RNA. I'll make a protein. And so it does. And it makes the spike protein, which is the stuff that decorates the coronavirus. And those spike proteins, the immune system says, oh, no, you don't, and makes an antibody to them. And it's very quick. That's why Pfizer and Moderna are the first two out of the gate, because the messenger RNA approach can be started almost immediately upon the time the virus is isolated. So it is a new approach. It looks extremely promising. It is going to be transformational, I think, for vaccines, for all kinds of things, because it looks like it's really worked. And this is the first time it's been taken all the way through to these phase three trials and FDA approval.
That was NIH Director Francis Collins speaking to VOA special contributor Greta Van Susteren. The Trump administration says some Americans could be just days away from getting a coronavirus vaccine, but there are fears some people may not want it. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has more.
Help is on the way.
Vice President Pence says vaccinations may start within 48 hours of federal regulators approving the drugs, what he calls historically fast progress.
Only in America.
But Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Chief Robert Redfield worries about a culture in America.
This growing concern of what I call vaccine hesitancy.
Some people just don't trust them.
It's really sad as an infectious disease physician to see many people choose to leave vaccination on the shelf.
Former presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama say they'd be willing to publicly take a coronavirus vaccine to boost confidence. Sagar Magani, Washington.
AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports Britain's quick approval for a COVID-19 vaccine has sparked speedy debate and an apology from America's top infectious disease expert, Anthony Fauci.
Britain's announcement, it's become the first Western country to authorize the use of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine, has generated comment over whether officials emphasize speed over safety. Health Secretary Ben Hancock has sparked a discussion, saying British authorities couldn't have moved so quickly if still a member of the European Union. That's drawn a rebuke from the EU, which pointed out Britain is still governed by the bloc's rules. Fauci, in an interview, said British regulators hadn't acted as carefully as the US Food and Drug Administration. He then said late Thursday he'd meant to say US authorities do things differently than their British counterparts, not better. But his comments weren't phrased properly. This week, Britain's regulatory authority gave temporary authorization for people to receive a vaccine. The agency made the decision under rules allowing regulators to sign off on medicines more quickly during public health emergencies. Charles de Ledesma, London.
In Asia, South Korea's capital of Seoul has announced unprecedented restrictions on Friday. The government is ordering most establishments and shops to close at 9 p.m. and cutting back public transportation operations by 30% in the evenings as daily coronavirus hit a nine-month high, calling the surge in cases a dire crisis. Health authorities urge South Koreans to cancel Christmas and New Year's parties, while President Moon Jae-in tapped an experienced pandemic fighter as his next health minister. And still to come in today's program.
There are about 6,000 satellites circling Earth right now. So something that's really important is making sure that these satellites don't run into each other.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers have found a number of possibly habitable exoplanets that reside in the so-called Goldilocks zone of their host stars. Researchers led by the Washington State University have discovered 24 exoplanets that may not only be habitable, but even more livable than Earth. A study published in the journal Astrobiology details their findings. The study authors say this collection of potential superhabitable exoplanets have suns that are better than our own and are more than 100 light years away. They found the planets have features that may make them more habitable, such as being older, slightly warmer and larger, and perhaps wetter than Earth. Study authors also found that planets orbiting slow-changing stars with extended lives could permit life to more easily thrive. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Hundreds of Rohingya were taken from refugee camps in Bangladesh to a remote island in the Bay of Bengal on Friday. Reuters' Adam Reed brings us that story.
Bangladesh has started moving Rohingya families from a port near its border with Myanmar to a remote island in the Bay of Bengal. Some 1,600 refugees were relocated on Friday in naval vessels, despite complaints by human rights groups that they were being coerced. Bashan Shah is a flood-prone island that emerged from the sea just 20 years ago. But Bangladesh's government says some Rohingya must be taken there to ease overcrowding in refugee camps. Two Rohingya being located told Reuters that their names appeared on lists compiled by government-appointed local leaders without their consent, while an 18-year-old woman said her husband had put their names on a list thinking it was for food rations. The Rohingya are a Muslim minority group which fled Myanmar for Bangladesh following a military-led crackdown in 2017. The UN has accused Myanmar of having a genocidal intent, but the government there says its forces were targeting militants. Now there are more than a million Rohingya living in crowded, squalid conditions in Bangladesh's refugee camps, where they're at risk of getting diseases.
Adam Reed reports for Reuters News. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees called on Bangladesh to uphold its commitment that the relocation of Rohingya to the island will be voluntary. The UNHCR said it stood ready to evaluate the conditions on the island to ensure that it is a safe and sustainable place for the refugees to live, if permitted by the government. A state judge in Nevada heard arguments Thursday on a bid by U.S. President Donald Trump's campaign to have him declare the winner of the election in Nevada or to nullify the results. Attorney Jesse Bednall argued the case in Carson City on behalf of six would-be Republican delegates to the Electoral College. Democrat Joe Biden won Nevada by 33,596 votes, but Bednall produced an expert who said he can show that nearly 87,000 improper or illegal votes were cast. Judge James Todd Russell said that he'll render a decision on Friday to allow time for an appeal to the state Supreme Court before the nationwide Electoral College finalizes results on December 14th. In an Associated Press tally of roughly 50 cases brought by Trump's campaign and his allies, more than 30 have been rejected or dropped, and about a dozen are still awaiting action. Attorney General Bill Barr, in an interview with the Associated Press, said that he has not seen any evidence of voter fraud that would have overturned the election results. Also, U.S. lawmakers have unveiled their final version of a massive annual defense policy bill that does not include several of U.S. President Donald Trump's demands. Reuters' Gloria So has those details.
U.S. lawmakers unveiled the final version of a massive annual defense bill Thursday, which defies several of President Donald Trump's demands. It would flout Trump's plans to withdraw troops from Germany and Afghanistan and contradict his wishes to keep the names of Confederate generals on U.S. military bases. It sets the stage for a veto fight in Trump's final weeks in office over a major $740 billion piece of legislation, which has been passed every year since 1961. The National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, addresses pay concerns for U.S. troops, aircraft and ship purchases, as well as how to deal with rivals like China and Russia. This year's bill would prevent Trump from slashing the number of active duty troops in Germany and Afghanistan below a certain level. Trump had also vowed to veto the bill because of a provision to strip the names of Confederate leaders from U.S. military bases, which passed with both Republican and Democrat support. And already this week, he'd insisted he will veto if the NDAA does not repeal legal protections for big tech companies like Facebook and Twitter, which he accuses of stifling conservative voices. The final bill did not include such a provision, as lawmakers said it has nothing to do with the military and should not be used to stop an important defense bill. Committee aides say they expect the House will pass the bill early next week, sending it to the Senate before going to Trump. They say it will be difficult to override a veto, with Congress in session only until the end of the year.
That was Reuters reporter Gloria So. The world immediately beyond Earth's atmosphere is far from lonely, silent, or boring. There are thousands of artificial satellites receiving and processing information and sending it back to Earth. Knowing just where the satellites are and what they are doing is becoming increasingly relevant to national security experts and to ordinary citizens every time they get online. And to find out more about satellite security and what it means for Earthlings, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with McKenna Young, a research associate at the Aerospace Security Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. She began by explaining the ramped-up importance of her work.
Well, there are so many actors in space right now, national actors, state actors, and we're seeing more and more commercial companies that are operating satellites in space. And those people have different objectives of what they want their satellites to be doing.
How many satellites are there right now in space, and what are the potential dangers?
There are about 6,000 satellites circling Earth right now. So something that's really important is making sure that these satellites don't run into each other and that they're all staying on their own track and aren't harming any other satellites.
How are they monitored?
The United States has a really large effort that we call space situational awareness. It's a bunch of different sensors and telescopes, operators and data that puts together a pretty full picture of what all's up there in space and how it's moving.
That's pretty elegant.
Not perfect. Not everyone shares all of their data. Not everyone wants everyone else to know where their satellite is. But there's a pretty large network, and we're trying to get a full picture of it.
Tell me more about the physical dangers to satellites.
So something really important is space debris. Something as small as a fleck of paint that comes off of your satellite can actually really harm another object if it hits it in space, and all satellites can be in danger.
How could damaged satellites affect us here on Earth?
Just using the internet is something that a lot of the world relies on satellites for. And it's becoming really, really important and ingrained in a lot of global society. You know, one of the biggest things is navigation or GPS that affects global militaries, citizens, and could really have a disastrous effect if a satellite was taken down that's supplying this navigation on Earth.
Of course, modern agriculture depends a lot on satellites.
Absolutely. A lot of farmers rely on satellite data to show them what the weather is going to be, what the crops were like last year, and how they can adapt and make their crops a little bit better. So space really affects almost everyone down on Earth, even if you might not realize it.
Keeping track of satellites and their positions and directions is also a military security issue, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are a lot of different ways to affect a satellite, from something physical that is shot up and destroys a satellite. It can be electronic, damaging some components of the space system or jamming the signals that are sent back to Earth from space, or even cyber attacks, hacking in to the networks and really messing with the data that the satellites are giving back to Earth. And that's definitely happening more and more with the more satellites and the more actors that are in space.
On one level, all this is just talking about traffic control challenges. But this isn't highway or even air traffic control we're talking about. What makes space different as a domain?
That's a great question. Something that makes space unique is that the objects can be a lot smaller. Something that we're seeing more are very, very small satellites. It can get pretty difficult trying to monitor exactly where they're going, what they're up to. Did they mean to make this change of direction? Are they doing it for a good reason, or should we be concerned about this shift? Those are some of the challenges.
What are you working on right now at your office?
Our team is working on a report right now assessing what different countries are doing to protect their satellites in space from some of these threats that I was talking about. Making sure that the frequencies they're using are protected. There's a lot that people can do on Earth to protect the satellite and make it harder to interrupt from a laser or something in space. There can be lasers that are on satellites in space that can be shot at other satellites and disrupt a camera or a frequency that they're communicating with back on Earth. And they can blind satellites that are orbiting and stop their functionality for a little bit. So there are a lot of ways to interfere with satellite operations. And we try to, you know, really get into some big questions about these threats in space and how the space domain is evolving and how it can be safe.
McKenna Young is a research associate at the Aerospace Security Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She was speaking to my colleague, Adam Phillips. Even in Africa's most vibrant cinematic market, Ife stands out. The tale of love between two Nigerian women has delayed the controversial film's release, leading to a battle with the nation's censorship board. VOA's Anita Powell spoke to the producer, as well as African LGBTQ activists, ahead of the film's December 10th online launch.
I told my mom first. Took her about him.
In the Yoruba language of Nigeria, Ife means love. But this love story between two women in a society where homosexuality is largely shunned and where same-sex marriage is illegal. The nation's censorship board threatened to go after the film's maker for promoting homosexuality in a film industry that, despite its huge output, is largely conservative. That has led the filmmakers to not push for local release. They instead plan to drop it online on December 10th.
Filmmakers here, mainstream filmmakers, usually shy away from telling stories that center LGBT people. And even when those stories are told, they are told from a very negative point of view.
More than 30 African countries criminalize non-heterosexual relationships. In 2018, Kenya's first lesbian feature film, Rafiki, was banned at home, despite the fact that it was the nation's first piece to premiere at the prestigious Cannes Film Festival. So who should watch this film? U.S.-based writer and filmmaker Noni Sama, who is Nigerian and transgender, said the answer is simple. Everybody.
I think it's a huge, it's a big deal for queer people, for lesbian women, for people who are not lesbian women, who, you know, just want to watch stuff that's outside, you know, the mainstream narrative, or even people who might be uncomfortable.
It's also a story of pain, says Adie, one that many members of the community can relate to.
I was pretty much rejected by my whole family, you know, especially my mom, who at some point asked me to move out of our family house. You know, and later on, she asked me to change my family name.
The same holds in South Africa, which was the first African nation to decriminalize homosexuality and allow gay marriage. Activist and storyteller Welcome Lashiva says even here, lesbians are overlooked and subjected to horrible treatment.
The story of lesbian women is no different from the story of women in general in relation to men, because we live in a deeply sexist society, a deeply patriarchal society.
So is Africa ready for this film? Adie will leave it to her characters, Ife and Adora, to answer that.
We're lesbians. This is the perfect time.
Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have an absolutely fantastic weekend.